He looked down at the body of the man in horror. Blood stained the sand. How could you have done it? Fear wrapped its fingers round his heart. He had murdered someone in cold blood. He ran and kept on running. She was beautiful. The water ran down her naked skin and the sunlight bathed her tanned body in a haze of loveliness. She was beautiful, and he felt the wanting of her like a physical hunger. The surge of his desire was fierce and unforgiving. Courtius listened in horror as he spat the words, "Bring her to me. I want her. Bring her now." The lynch mob was in full voice. "String him up. Stone him." The serious young man stood proud and superior and watched the ugly drama unfold. Excited by their bloodlust, they led their hapless victim to the place of execution. And the young man held the courts while the final bloody business was done. He did nothing to stop it. In fact, he was glad they were doing it. The heretic had it coming to him. The threat was unmistakable. "Pay up, or the might of Rome will come crashing through your door like a sledgehammer. Pay the little man his extortion money, or he would get his powerful, no questions asked, friends in the Roman army to work the place over. Picture it. Broken furniture and broken limbs. Was it worth it? Better just to pay him what he wanted. Submit to his blackmail, the little quisling." The woman trembled with fear. Caught in the act, in flagrante delicto. The embarrassment and shame burned into her, and the cold terror chilled her heart as the crowd seized her and hurled her to the ground. She shuddered as she waited for the judgment, the condemnation, and the hail of rocks that would kill her. So who are these people? A murderer and an adulterer, a thief, a pious persecutor of the church, a greedy collaborator who robs his own people, a woman exposed in her immorality. Who are these people, if not icons of hope within the Bible? Icons of hope, signposts of possibility, symbols of salvation. Moses the murderer, Saul of Tarsus the grim persecutor of Stephen and the early church, Zacchaeus the slimeball extortionist, David the murderous king, and that nameless woman caught in the act. All key figures in our developing understanding of what our faith is really about and who it's for. It is, from start to finish, a faith that rehabilitates, raises the fallen, gives hope to the broken, the faith of second chances. And Peter, of course, another classic example of the hope that lies within the Christian understanding of new beginnings, the glorious truth that crippling, abject failure need not be the whole story, nor indeed speak the final word about us. The experience of Peter, like that of those other unlikely heroes and heroines of the faith, invites us to ask, who are we? How do we perceive ourselves, those who call themselves the followers of Christ? Robert Burns caricatured, or was it an accurate description of the church of his day? He certainly gave the picture of the church as a congregation of the uncogid, quick to condemn, confident in their own righteousness, and oblivious, tragically oblivious, to their own shortcomings and lack of compassion. If this is who we think we are, those who wear their goodness on their sleeve and carry their propriety around with them like a big black Bible, then we surely haven't found that model from within the pages of that Bible. It is the record, the glorious record of the salvation of the fallen, the restoration of the hopeless, the affirmation of the ordinary. The Bible offers the stirring and hope-filled account of those who have been on the receiving end of God's grace and the miracle business of his forgiveness, his power to turn lives around, his conviction of the worth of each of his children, and the possibility within even the least likely candidate for sainthood. There was for me a defining moment at the General Assembly of 1984 when the Church of Scotland was challenged to make a decision about the appointment of a man called James Nelson as a candidate for the ministry. James Nelson was, as some of you may remember, a convicted murderer who had served several years in prison for killing his mother in a fit of rage. And in essence, the church was being asked with directness and clarity, Who are we? What do we understand ourselves to be? Guardians of the moral conscience, standing tall and secure in our certainties, with the dangerous arrogance of those who are safe in their comfortable moral superiority? Or was the Church of Scotland driven, dominated and defined by the gospel of forgiveness? Was the hallmark of the Church a judgmental spirit or a heart filled with compassion? Or was acceptance being confused with naive sentimentality? What was the message of the Church? Where was it coming from? From up there on the pedestal? Or from alongside real men and women who struggled with temptation, who stumbled and fell? Was Christianity a faith for the strong, or good news and hope for the weak and the compromised? Well, that General Assembly made the historic decision that indeed it was possible for people to be changed, restored, rehabilitated. It sparked a huge debate within the Church as elders and members alike tried to deal with the issue and come to an understanding of the Church's identity. Devout practitioners of the good life, or sinners saved by grace? And Peter is a paradigm of this reality, a model on which we can build our deepest conviction of the nature and the thrust of the faith in which we stand. Peter, with foul-mouthed curses, denies his Lord. Yet Peter the weasel can be Peter the shepherd, entrusted with a high calling. Peter the coward can, by the grace of God, be Peter the rock. Peter the quitter, who finds it too hot in the kitchen, can be the brave bishop who goes to martyrdom in Rome. There is no end to God's surprises, miracles, transformations. This, it appears, is the business we're in, or rather the business God is in, taking the tired lethargy of our half-hearted minimalist religion and making us, if we want to be, creative servants of his kingdom. From the rough and ready raw material of our ordinary brand of Christianity and Christian commitment, he can fashion something beautiful and valuable, no matter who we are, where we have been, what we have done. The Bible insists against all human logic in trusting to the divine logic that we are valued by God and needed by him to do his work. This is where the celebration of the sacrament is so important and so healing. We're not there at the table by right or as a reward. We're there because regardless of our faltering faith, our tarnished life, his grace is sufficient for all our need, and he makes provision for us to feast at his supper. So the Holy Table is the place of restoration, new beginnings, fresh starts, clean sheets. Sadly, ironically, this is the very place where we encounter the appalling heresy that pervades the Highlands of Scotland. The heresy that we have to measure up before we dare presume to take the cup and eat the bread. We have to measure up before we dare presume. So generations withdraw from the table until they feel they are good enough, holy-minded enough, as if they will ever be that, or as if they were able to judge whether they were that or not. There is an invitation to his table, not to the good people with no blots on their copybook, who can affirm that for so many months they've been this good or that good. Utter folly to stay away from the Lord's table, utter cruelty to condemn others to stay away until they reckon they are qualified to be participants of the feast. They miss the grace shown by the God of second chances and put pressure on others to miss the grace too. So wrong, so sad, so not gospel.